Usually, the gaming industry operates on a set of physics that are pretty predictable.
Yeah, Newtonian almost.
Right, exactly. You know the drill. Bad games launch, they flop, and they sort of just they die quietly in the night to save face.
Sequels play it safe to keep the quarterly earnings stable.
Yep, and hardware secrets. They are guarded like nuclear launch codes until the marketing department explicitly decides otherwise.
It's a comfortable rhythm, you know? A bit cynical, maybe, but comfortable. You generally know exactly what to expect from the big players.
We do. But today, we are throwing that rule book completely out the window for this deep dive.
We really have to.
We've got a stack of reports here from the end of February 2026, specifically a technical war room analysis from a group called Tekin Garage. And looking through this, I mean, things are getting weird. The source literally describes this week as defying the physics of the industry.
It really does. And to be clear about what we're looking at here, this isn't a stack of gaming magazine reviews or
Right,
editorials.
it's not opinion pieces.
Exactly. Tekin Garage is a collective of back-end engineers and data analysts. This report, which is dated February 24, 2026, is essentially a debugging log of the entire market.
So they're looking at the raw data.
They're analyzing server packet loss, looking at compiled code leaks, and tracking sentiment shifts in real time. It's less like a review and more like an autopsy of a living system.
That is a very vivid image, debugging the market. So, our mission today is to do exactly that for you. We're going to unpack a massive AAA resurrection that honestly shouldn't be technically possible.
Really unprecedented.
We're going to look at some indie gambles that are frankly terrifying from a design standpoint, and we're going to figure out why the market seems to be shifting phases right now.
It covers the full spectrum. I mean, you have the corporate giants and the small indie labs, and for once, they are both doing completely unexpected things at the exact same time.
Let's start with the giant. And honestly, this is the story that grabbed me first because I had completely written this game off. We really need to talk about Monster Hunter Wilds.
We do. Now, for anyone who follows live service games, there is an unwritten law. It's almost absolute. Once a massive AAA title hits, mostly negative on Steam,
The clock starts ticking.
the clock starts ticking. It's a death
I
sentence.
can't think of many that come back from that. I
Yeah.
mean, usually they just fold.
Very few. You have maybe 6 to 8 months. The concurrent player base collapses, the Steam algorithms stop recommending it because engagement is completely down, and the servers are quietly moved to what we call maintenance mode.
Right, just keeping the lights on.
Exactly. It's a slow fade into the digital graveyard while the studio just moves on to the next project.
And Monster Hunter Wilds was standing right on that ledge. I remember the launch discussions vividly. Horrific PC performance, servers desyncing right in the middle of hunts.
Unplayable for a lot of people.
Yeah, and the loot system, I mean, punishing is a polite way to put it. It felt like the game was actively fighting you, and not in a fun, challenging way. It was just heavy on the microtransactions.
It was a classic case of the monetization model getting in the way of the actual gameplay loop, but this is where the anomaly happens. According to the Tekin Garage report, Capcom didn't pull the plug.
Which is wild.
Right. They didn't just issue a standard, we're listening JPEG apology on Twitter and have a vague roadmap. They performed what the source calls open heart surgery.
That sounds drastic. What does that actually look like in code? Because usually patches are just band-aids, right? They tweak a few numbers.
This means they risked breaking the game further to fix it fundamentally. This wasn't a surface level patch to fix some missing textures. The report details a mega patch that plowed through the entire back-end infrastructure. They optimized the RE engine's memory cache specifically to fix those erratic frame rates.
Can you pause right there? Memory cache optimization. We hear that buzzword a lot in patch notes. Why is that such a huge deal for a game like Monster Hunter?
So the RE engine, which runs Resident Evil and Monster Hunter, is gorgeous, but it's very heavy.
Yeah.
Think of the memory cache like a short-term memory for your computer. If the engine isn't clearing out old data fast enough, like, say, textures for a monster that has already left the area, the system chokes trying to hold on to everything at once.
Oh, so it gets bloated.
Exactly. That's what causes those stuttering frame drops you were seeing. Fixing that requires deep, dangerous coding, because if you clear the wrong thing, the game just crashes entirely.
Okay, so they went into the basement and completely fixed the engine foundation, but they also touched the netcode, right?
They rewrote it to eliminate packet loss. For a game that relies on precise timing with three other players in real time, that is absolutely non-negotiable.
Right, because of the dodge timings.
Yes. If you're swinging a greatsword and the server thinks you're 3 feet to the left because of a single lost packet, the game feels broken. It feels unfair.
But the part that surprised me most wasn't even technical, it was the economy.
Yes. They restructured the in-game economy to favor the gamer's time. They actually dialed back the grind.
That never happens. I mean, usually once the monetization hooks are in, publishers fight tooth and nail to keep them there because that's their revenue stream. Why would they voluntarily make it easier to get items without paying?
Because they realized the patient was dying on the table. You can't monetize a player base that has already uninstalled the game. The report suggests this was a massive strategic pivot to prioritize long-term retention over short-term extraction.
So what's the result? Is the patient surviving the surgery?
It's frantic. The report says Steam reviews have crossed the 50% mixed threshold and are climbing vertically.
Wow.
Do you know how hard it is to move that needle once you have thousands of negative reviews anchoring you down? It's mathematically
It's
grueling.
a proper redemption arc.
It really is. And the insight here is crucial for anyone watching the industry. The source puts it perfectly. Gamers have long memories for launch day betrayal.
Oh, absolutely.
That scar tissue is there. But if a studio fixes the source code, and I mean really fixes it, and swallows that corporate pride to bring respect back to the mechanics, players will return.
There's a note here from Sabrina, who is listed as the creative lead at the garage. She says something that really stuck with me when I was reading this. She said, "A bad game that gets abandoned stays bad forever, but a broken game repaired with passion creates loyalty stronger than day one."
That's the psychological angle of all this.
Yeah, it transforms the game from just a product you bought into a shared journey. It becomes interactive art because you, as the player, watched it heal. You were part of that recovery.
It shows that the technical health of a game is directly tied to the emotional health of the community. You really can't separate the code from the culture.
Speaking of code helping, Monster Hunter Recover wasn't the only thing hidden in that huge update file. And this is where the deep dive gets a little conspiratorial, which I love.
Ah, yes. Here's where it gets really interesting for the hardware geeks out there.
While everyone was looking at the frame rates and the new loot drops, the data miners were looking at the strings. The source mentions that hidden inside this Monster Hunter Wilds PC update were encrypted strings pointing to something very, very specific.
ARM architecture instructions and specific API calls.
Okay, help us out here. I know my PC runs up i86. Why does finding ARM architecture in a PC game patch matter at all?
So you're exactly right. Most PCs run on x86 architecture, like Intel or AMD. Mobile devices, and specifically the Nintendo Switch, run on ARM.
They speak different languages.
Exactly. Finding ARM instructions inside a high-fidelity PC patch is like finding a motorcycle engine part inside a semi-truck. It just shouldn't be there unless you are actively planning to build a motorcycle.
So it points to a handheld. But the Switch has been out for ages. Why is this news? Couldn't it just be leftover old code from a previous port?
That's what I thought at first, too. But the API calls, which is the way the software talks to the hardware, are tailored for a device that doesn't officially exist yet.
Oh, wow.
The identifiers do not match the current Switch. The evidence is pointing irrefutably to the Nintendo Switch 2.
So Capcom is prepping Wilds for the Switch 2. But here's my skepticism. Wilds is a beast of a game. We just talked about how it struggled on high-end PCs at launch. How in the world are they going to squeeze that onto a portable console without it looking like a blurry potato?
That is the big aha moment from the report. You're right, the Aryan engine is completely starved for memory bandwidth and CPU power. If Capcom is confident enough to put code in this update preparing for a port, it implies something massive about the Switch 2's actual hardware.
It's not just a small iterative upgrade, then.
It can't be. It suggests the GPU architecture has taken a terrifying leap forward compared to the old Tegra X1 in the current Switch.
Terrifying in a good way.
Right. We're likely looking at hardware-level support for AI upscaling, something like DLSS or FSR. That's realistically the only way you get a game this heavy to run on a battery-powered
So
device.
it renders low and upscales high.
Yes. The handheld isn't rendering the full 4K natively. It's rendering a lower resolution and using AI to fill in the gaps perfectly.
So basically, by analyzing a PC patch for a Monster Hunting game, we've confirmed that the next Nintendo console is a powerhouse.
In a way, yes. And think about the strategic impact of that. Nintendo has this incredible culture of local co-op, right? Sitting on the couch, being in the same room. Combine that with the gameplay loop of Monster Hunter, which is entirely about teaming up with friends.
It's the ultimate system seller.
Exactly. If this port works flawlessly, it could completely define the portable market for 2026. It's a convergence of high-end tech and social gameplay that we really haven't seen on a handheld before.
Okay, let's pivot a bit. We've talked about the AAA giant coming back from the dead and the hardware secrets leaking out, but the source says we need to turn our radar to the beating heart of the industry, the indies.
Yes, and specifically, a sequel that is taking a massive, massive gamble. Slay the Spire 2.
March 5th, early access.
I feel like
half the internet has this date circled in red marker. I definitely do.
For very good reason. The first Slay the Spire look, it didn't invent the roguelike deck builder genre, but it perfected it. It was a mathematical masterpiece.
It spawned literally 1,000 clones.
It did, but none of them ever quite hit that exact same balance. It was rigid, it was precise, and wildly addictive. So making a sequel is already a scary prospect. How do you improve on mathematical perfection?
And their answer is apparently co-op.
Which sounds super fun on paper, but from a design perspective, it's an absolute nightmare.
Why is it so risky, though? I mean, multiplayer's in everything right now. Why is it so hard for a card game? Just let two people play cards.
Because of the math. Slay the Spire is entirely about rigid calculations. You have exact damage numbers, exact block numbers, highly specific relics. When you add a second player, you aren't just adding another character sprite to the screen. You're completely doubling the variables.
Right. You have to balance card synergies between two people now. Plus, the enemy scaling has to adjust.
Your source has a fantastic analogy here attributed to Claude, one of their analysts. He compares it to CPU architecture.
Oh, I like this one. Break it down for us.
He says adding co-op to a rigid card game like this is like adding a new core to a single core CPU. If they aren't synced up perfectly, the system bottlenecks. It crashes conceptually.
You just end up getting in each other's way.
Exactly. If I play a card that discards your hand, I've just ruined your entire turn.
But if it works...
If it works, the output implies an exponential multiplier. The strategy becomes infinitely deeper because now you're setting up plays for your partner, not just yourself. You tank the big hit so they can charge up the massive attack.
It's extremely high risk, high reward.
And the hype totally reflects that risk. The source mentions a red alert status on Reddit and Twitter right now.
Mm.
When those servers open on March 5th, the traffic is going to be unprecedented.
It's going to melt down.
Probably. It's a test of whether you can take a solitary, highly thoughtful genre and turn it into a loud social experience without breaking the underlying math.
It's going to be chaotic, and I honestly can't wait. Now, speaking of chaos, or maybe the opposite of it, let's talk about physics. The report mentions a huge trend of games launching their 1.0 versions right now to escape the crowded release windows later in the year.
Which is a very smart strategy. Get your game out before the marketing noise of the holidays becomes deafening.
Right. And one of these is Tides of Tomorrow. It's being described as atmospheric and story-driven. But the Tech and Garage report focuses on something highly specific. The water.
Fluid dynamics. It sounds dry pun fully intended. But getting water right is one of the hardest things to do in game development.
Why is that? I feel like we've had water in games since BioShock. What makes this implementation different?
Well, we've had visuals of water for a long time. The simulating the actual physics of water, calculating how waves displace mass, how foam generates dynamically, how the water pushes back against a floating object in real time is incredibly CPU intensive.
It's all math.
Exactly. And the source says the developers here have transferred the weight and brutality of the ocean directly to the controller.
That is a very visceral description.
It is. It suggests they're using the haptics in the controller and the physics engine to make you physically feel the struggle. It's not just a flat blue texture you float on anymore. It's a physical force. They're calling it a visual benchmark for early 2026.
It definitely sounds like one you want to play with the headphones on and the lights turned all the way down.
Yeah.
But if you want something a little less narrative and a lot more stressful, there's Rise of Piracy.
Now, this is an important distinction we need to make. When people hear pirate game, they immediately think Sea of Thieves.
Right. They think arcade fun, shooting skeletons out of cannons, eating bananas whole to heal.
Yes. This is not that at all.
No. Rise of Piracy is a ruthless simulator.
We're talking spreadsheets and wind vectors here.
Spreadsheets? Really?
We're talking complex ship economy management, wind physics that actually matter to your trajectory, and managing crew morale. You aren't just steering a boat. You're managing a floating, hungry ecosystem. If you don't calculate your food rations correctly, your crew mutinies and you lose. If you don't angle the sails to the exact wind vector, you just stop moving in the middle of the ocean.
It sounds like it fills a massive void, though. There are plenty of action pirate games, but not many that treat piracy like a historical logistical challenge.
Exactly. It's really for the hardcore PC crowd that wants to feel the difficulty of the era,
yeah.
Not just the Disney fantasy of it. It's about survival, not just swashbuckling adventure.
Which brings us perfectly to the survival of the games themselves. We've talked about these big titles, but the source makes a very strong point about the hidden gems of the industry.
This is the eternal struggle for developers, the algorithm.
Steam's algorithm is incredibly ruthless. It loves what's already popular.
It creates a massive feedback loop. Big games get bigger, and true innovation gets completely buried on page 10. The Tekken Report highlights that true innovation, the actual evolution of the gameplay loop, rarely comes from the AAA studios anymore. They just have too much money on the line to take big mechanical risks.
Right. Innovation comes from the smaller studios that can't afford hyper-realistic graphics, so they have to make sure the game is actually fun to play.
Precisely. They rely entirely on mechanics. The source identified 5 fresh titles, roguelikes, turn-based games, Metroidvanias, that are completely flying under the radar right now. And the point they make is that these small studios are the ones coding on the bleeding edge of game design.
We'll definitely have to keep an eye out and do a specific deep dive on those 5 gems later. But for now, I want to pivot to the so what of this deep dive. We have listeners who are prepping to jump into Monster Hunter or getting ready to coordinate perfectly and slay the Spire. What does all this mean for you practically?
This is the survival guide section of the report, and I love how practical it gets. It's not just telling you to go buy this game, it's telling you to prepare your hardware.
Because with games like these, performance isn't just about making it look pretty, it's purely functional.
Right. If you are playing Monster Hunter Wilds at high frame rates, or making split-second combo decisions in Slay the Spire 2, technical performance is critical. The source flat out calls lag strategic suicide.
That's intense. Strategic suicide. But I guess if you're playing a hardcore simulation or a frame-perfect action game, you can't have your tools fighting against you.
Exactly. If your mouse has a tiny bit of input delay or your keyboard isn't registering the keystroke instantly, you are failing not because of your skill level, but because of your gear.
So what's the actual recommendation from the Inspector Tekken Garage? Do we all need to go out and buy $1,000 esports equipment?
Not necessarily $1,000 gear, but they get very specific about the types of gear you need. They highly highlight high DPI optical pinpoint mice. You really need that pixel-perfect precision. But the big one for me was the keyboards. They strongly recommend mechanical keyboards with zero latency optical switches.
Okay, optical switches use light instead of physical contact, right? Explain the difference to someone who just uses a standard membrane office keyboard.
Go. Sure. So a traditional mechanical switch has 2 tiny metal pieces that physically touch to complete an electrical circuit. That physical contact creates what we call debounce time, a tiny millisecond delay where the signal stabilizes before sending it to the PC.
Okay, that makes sense.
But an optical switch just breaks a beam of infrared light. It's instant actuation. There is zero debounce delay. You press it, the game reacts immediately.
And they also mentions studio-grade headsets.
Yes, specifically for the audio cues. In a game like Wilds, hearing exactly where the monster is behind you before you even turn around is half the battle. Or in Tides of Tomorrow, hearing the water crashing to know which way the current is pulling your boat. The takeaway here is that upgrading your setup isn't just about spending money to look cool, it's about securing your operational base.
I really like that framing. Securing your operational base. It's about preserving your digital sanity. Because nothing makes you rage quit faster than dying because your gear couldn't keep up with your brain.
Exactly. If you're going to invest hundreds of hours into these deep, complex worlds, you really need to ensure the interface between you and the code is as seamless as possible.
So let's unpack this whole deep dive. We've covered a massive amount of ground today.
We really have. We started with the idea that the industry follows safe rules, and we proved that this February, those rules are completely broken.
We saw dead code come magically back to life with Monster Hunter Wilds, proving that redemption is actually possible if studios actually fix the root problems.
We saw leaks buried in that exact same code pointing to a massive AI-driven hardware leap for Nintendo.
We saw Slay the Spire 2 risking its legendary legacy to try and reinvent its own genre with co-op math.
And we looked at the intense physics simulations in Tides of Tomorrow and Rise of Piracy, pushing the boundaries of what realism means in a game.
It really does feel like a phase shift. The market isn't just releasing games anymore, it's rapidly evolving.
It is. And if I had to offer one final provocative thought to leave you with, it's this. In this current ecosystem, which the source describes as ruthless and unforgiving, the power dynamic is shifting entirely.
How so?
The only survivors, and I mean both studios and players, are the ones who adapt. For studios, it's the ones who finally listen to their community and aren't afraid to perform open-heart surgery on their own failing products instead of abandoning them. And for you, the gamer, it's the ones who are technically prepared, the ones who understand that their hardware is actually part of their in-game strategy.
It's not just about playing the game anymore. It's about understanding the machine that runs it.
Precisely. The wall between the developer's code and the player's hardware is thinner than ever. At the end of the day, we're all just debugging the exact same source code together.
That is a great place to leave it. So go check your latency, maybe look into those optical switches we talked about, and as always, stay curious.
Thanks for listening to this deep dive.
Catch you in the lobby.